This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning for Morningstar.
Our guest this week is Dave Sequeira. Dave is Chief U.S. Market Strategist for Morningstar Research Services. In his role, Dave publishes research and commentary on the state of the markets and is a leading voice on Morningstar.com and other platforms. Before assuming his current role, Dave was a Managing Director for DBRS Morningstar. Prior to joining Morningstar in 2010, Dave worked in the alternative asset management field. Dave earned his bachelor's degree in finance and decision sciences from Miami University and holds the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. You can follow him on Twitter at @mstarmarkets. Dave, welcome to The Long View.
Hey, Jeff, how are you doing?
We're doing well. Thanks so much for being here. Why don't we start in a logical place, given your role, which is looking at the stock market. Maybe you could talk about, through the lens by which you assess market valuations, does the market look cheap, dear, or reasonably priced right now? And what leads you to that conclusion?
So following the rally that we've already had in the first half of this year, you know, the market's still at a slight discount, trading at about a 5% discount to a composite of our fair values. Whereas at the beginning of the year, it was actually pretty significantly undervalued, trading at about a 16% discount to our fair value. And I think it's important for listeners to understand, you know, how we think about value and look at the markets overall, because I really think we have a different take in how we do our market valuations as compared to a lot of other market strategists. So we really take a bottoms-up approach on our equity research group here at Morningstar. You know, we cover over 1,500 stocks globally. You know, of that, you know, there's over 700 that we cover that trade on U.S. exchanges. And what I do is I will take a composite of the intrinsic valuation as assigned by all of our equity analysts and compare that to where those stocks are actually trading in the marketplace in order to come up with, you know, that price to fair value. So really that bottoms up approach. Whereas, you know, what I see a lot of other strategists do is they always have this top down approach. And, you know, they have some sort of model or algorithm and they'll come up with their estimate for what they think, you know, S&P 500 earnings are going to be at the end of the year, and then they come up with, you know, some sort of forward multiple that they apply to that in order to get to, you know, their target price, which maybe I'm just being cynical here, but it always seems that their target price, you know, ends up being anywhere, you know, 8 to 10% higher than, you know, where the market is currently. So I think that's part of the difference in, you know, why we find that oftentimes our view for market valuation could be very different than what the consensus is.
Just to follow up, can you explain real briefly for the benefit of listeners who might be less familiar, how a Morningstar stock analyst would evaluate a stock? You know, there's different approaches, even within sort of bottom-up security selection. How do they do it?
Sure. So we start with, you know, the really a fundamental bottoms-up approach. So each analyst will take a look at not only, you know, the individual company, but take a look at, you know, the entire sector that they cover and how that company fits within that sector and how they compete. And as part of that analysis, you know, we look to determine whether or not we think a company has an economic moat. So essentially, kind of very, you know, Graham and Dodd or Warren Buffett-esque type approach. You know, does this company have long-term durable competitive advantages, which will help that company be able to generate excess returns over invested capital over the long term? And I think that's really one of the big differentiators we have, you know, compared to how a lot of other people look at, you know, valuations. So once we've done that, we will build a full discounted cash flow model. And then within that, you know, we will incorporate, you know, how long we think a company can generate those excess returns. So for example, I always assume a company, you know, even if they're generating excess returns today, you know, competitors will see those excess returns, they'll enter that space and be able to quickly compete those returns away. Now, a company that we deem to have a narrow economic moat, we expect that that is going to be able to allow that company to generate those excess returns, you know, for the next 10 years. And a company with a wide economic moat can generate those excess returns, you know, for the next 20 years or more. And so when I think about how that impacts our valuations, you know, those companies that do have those economic moats, you know, all else being equal, will be worth more than companies that don't have an economic moat, because they will be able to generate those excess returns, you know, for that longer time period.
So, Dave, just to follow up, maybe you can talk about how a measure like the Shiller-Cape ratio, the cyclically adjusted PE ratio, is different and is sort of a top-down measure versus the one that our analysts use. Because, it, you know, if you're looking at the Shiller-Cape ratio today, you see a sort of flashing red, whereas you just indicated that we aren't that worried, that valuations look reasonable to us. So maybe you can contrast those two ways of looking at the market.
Yeah, and I'm always very cautious whenever, you know, people are talking about, you know, historical metrics and how they've been applied in the past and, you know, what that might tell investors, you know, thinking about returns going forward. So when I started in finance, you know, back in 1990, you know, the largest stocks by market cap were companies like Exxon, IBM, Merck, Coke, you know, companies that had very different business models, you know, very different sectors, you know, growth rates, margins, things that were very different than, you know, what we see the largest stocks are, you know, in the marketplace today. So while I do think that some of those ratios can be helpful, I don't think that what the market looks like today is always necessarily comparable to what it might have looked like in the past. Yeah, and then the other part too is with our valuation, I'll look at PE ratios and forward PE ratios, but those really aren't used in our valuation process. That's really more an end product than it is necessarily a determinant for valuation. And in fact, you know, I often find that PEs have a pretty poor track record for really helping investors time their investments. You know, when I think about like a PE ratio and, you know, even like the Cape E ratio, it's really going to be based on a snapshot in time for earnings. And I don't think that necessarily appropriately measures long-term earnings growth and cash flow. So again, you know, when I think about the intrinsic value of a company, you know, it's not just a metric as far as, you know, what they're going to earn next year and some sort of, you know, estimate on top of that. It is truly the present value of all the future free cash flow that a firm will generate over its lifetime. And then using, you know, an appropriate discounted cash flow model to come up with those long-term projections for revenue, changes in margin, you know, capital allocation, and so forth, and in order to determine that intrinsic value.
When we had the washout last year, it seemed like people were saying this would mark the start of a new era in which value beats growth. How has that played out?
Yeah, I always am cautious, you know, when people are talking about a new era of anything, you know, in the financial market. And at this point, yeah, I think it's really going to be, you know, too early to tell whether or not value beating growth will last over the next several years. But I always think, you know, things always in finance come back to valuation. And irrespective of if a stock is considered to be a value stock, a core stock, or a growth stock, it's going to be based on, you know, where is that stock trading in the marketplace today compared to what you think that stock is worth based on that intrinsic valuation. So, for example, you know, at the beginning of 2022, according to our composite, you know, we noted that the market was overvalued and that growth stocks, especially the technology sector, you know, were overvalued. Now, the value category was trading only slightly under our fair value estimates, but on a relative value basis was the most undervalued part of the market, especially the defensive sectors. So to the downside in 2022, you know, value stocks, you know, substantially outperformed growth stocks. But having said that, we do think the markets then overshot to the downside in 2022. So then coming into 2023, when we looked at our valuations, we actually thought the market was pretty substantially undervalued, with both value and growth categories trading at substantial discounts to fair value, whereas the core sector was much closer to being fairly valued. So at that point, you know, we really advocated for what we called the barbell-shaped portfolio, where we thought investors should be overweight both value and growth and underweight core, you know, based on those valuations. Now, as you know, the market has moved and we've seen growth stocks really be the predominant part of the market that's, you know, really made the strong returns in the first half of this year, those stocks as a category are really starting to approach, you know, fair value. And so we've recently been updating our recommendation, telling investors that now is actually probably a pretty good time to be taking some profits, you know, from the growth category and begin to move to more of a underweight position in growth stocks generally, but then reallocate those profits, you know, into the value category, you know, which has lagged and in our view remains significantly undervalued and much better positioned for returns going forward.
So to follow up on that, U.S. stocks in aggregate have had a good year so far. Can you break down the source of those returns between earnings per share growth, multiple expansion, and yield?
And, you know, the way that we look at the market, you know, those aren't necessarily the terms in how I think about how to measure returns. And so when we're looking at, you know, our valuations and thinking about, you know, what some of the best positioning for investors would be going forward, we really want to find those areas that either one, you know, are undervalued and have lagged that we do think will provide better returns going forward. Whereas, you know, we're looking for those other areas that have become overvalued and overextended to take profits and make those reallocations based on those current valuations.
Have share buybacks remained an important source of earnings growth for firms? And what is the overall trend in share repurchases been?
Yeah, so share buybacks have certainly gotten, you know, some negative press, you know, earlier this year. But, you know, in our view, they do remain a valuable tax-efficient tool for companies to support shareholder returns and support earnings growth. But I do think long-term investors need to look past that short-term impact of share buybacks and think more in terms of how those buybacks may or may not impact the value of a company. So, for example, like where management is able to buy back stock at a discount to intrinsic valuation, you know, we do think that that will end up bolstering, you know, future shareholder returns. However, when management teams are buying back stock above intrinsic value, that ends up actually being more of a detriment to future returns. But I think it also really brings up a much larger question, and that's for investors to think about, you know, how management is using the free cash flow that the company generates and whether or not that management team are good stewards of that capital, you know, and using that cash flow to build additional long-term value for the investors over time. And when I think about, you know, how management teams use cash flow, you know, first, I think most management teams will look to see if there's ways that they can invest in organic growth opportunities. And to me, that's always kind of my preferred use of cash flow, where they're able to take cash and reinvest directly into their own business. Second, I think management teams will then, you know, look to see whether or not, you know, there's potential acquisitions that they think may be synergistic for the company. I always want to make sure I cast a very cautious eye on that. You know, there are certainly instances where acquisitions will build long-term value, but also lots of other examples out there where it has destroyed capital. So I think as an investor, you need to take a very careful look when they do make acquisitions. You know, third, they can use that cash to repay debt, which, you know, for a company that's over-leveraged, that's probably a good use of cash. Or they can let that cash build on the balance sheet, which then provides, you know, future optionality. So then lastly, the management team, when you have, you know, the cash left over from those activities, determine, you know, whether or not to make dividend payments, you know, and or share buybacks. And so there's going to be several different considerations. You know, some companies in specific sectors may want to not do dividend payments because, again, once you start paying dividends, you know, more people think of that as being more of a value stock as opposed to a growth stock. And, you know, management teams are also going to be very apprehensive of raising their dividends too much that they won't be able to support that dividend in the future. You know, management teams never want to cut dividends, you know, over time. And so when all of that is put together, that really ends up determining when they take those capital allocations, is that going to be something that builds that long-term value or not?
So, Dave, you previously referenced the fact that U.S. growth stocks, especially technology stocks, have been so dominant this year. And you've written about how concentrated the U.S. market is in its top holdings, especially some of those names. So do the data suggest that that's cause for concern?
You know, I've seen some reports out there trying to make that. But for me, you know, the concentration in and of itself doesn't necessarily concern me. I think it's more a matter of how investors should think about how they may want to position their portfolios based on the current valuations and then how that may impact their future returns. So as you mentioned, you know, it's very concentrated right now. And in fact, you know, the Magnificent Seven, as they're being called, you know, do account for, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of the market return this year. Now, it's interesting in that, you know, when you look at those seven specific mega cap stocks, of those, six of those seven were rated either 4 stars or 5 stars at the beginning of this year, you know, indicating that we thought that they were significantly undervalued. Now, following this rally, only one is actually still undervalued and rated 4 stars. 4 of those stocks are fairly valued, rated 3 stars, and 2 of them are now actually in overvalued territory and rated 2 stars. So at this point, you know, when I think about what we expect from the market going forward for this market rally to continue, I think it really needs to spread out, you know, into the value category and out of the growth and actually start going down in capitalization, down into the mid cap and the small cap area and away from the large cap.
So maybe to follow up on that and stick with what you just mentioned, which kind of gets at what investors might want to be thinking about given the level of concentration of what it sounds like is, you know, full valuation of some of those top index constituents. I mean, are you suggesting that they should be thinking about leaning a little bit more towards value where they'd find some of those more reasonably priced names? Or should they just sit tight in sort of confidence that the index normally turns? This is not an uncommon state of affairs and it'll sort of work itself out over time.
And I think a lot of that is going to depend on personal investor preferences and what their own, you know, risk appetite might be. At this point, you know, what the valuations are telling me today is that, you know, the growth stocks are pretty close to fairly valued. So we would expect that they will make, you know, over time, the cost of equity on average, you know, for the group of stocks, which, you know, is typically around, you know, 8% to 9%. But what we do see is a better margin of safety in the value area with those stocks trading at about a 15% discount to those fair values. So we would expect that over time, not only will those stocks, you know, earn their cost of equity, but that as those value stocks trade up closer to fair value, that you'll be able to get, you know, some extra return over time. Now, having said that, there's always, you know, different sentiment in the marketplace, you know, lots of different reasons why some stocks may perform better than others, you know, in the short term. So, you know, based on that, I think it is going to be dependent on the investor as far as whether or not they're willing to take on, you know, some of that extra risk. But with that extra margin of safety, I do think that that helps provide, you know, some downside cushion.
So sticking with the S&P 500, does that suggest that the methodology is flawed in the way that it allows that degree of concentration? Or do you think people get too hung up on how the largest constituents of the index fare because their own underperformance is more than offset by something that comes along to replace them?
You know, I don't think it's necessarily that the index in and of itself is flawed, but I do think that it's just something that I think investors need to be aware of, you know, in their own individual portfolio positioning and how to think about, you know, as they make reallocations within their portfolio, where they may want to make those reallocations, you know, based on current valuations.
Let's switch over and talk about sectors. Maybe we can start with the most overvalued parts of the market. What's looking frothy and what has to go right for these stocks to justify the price that's being asked?
Yeah, and following, you know, this huge rally that we've had thus far this year in the technology sector, that's now the sector that is most overvalued in our view, you know, trading about a 7 to 10% premium to our fair valuations. And it's interesting, this is the first time that tech actually has now been in overvalued territory since the beginning of 2022. And to some degree, I think a lot of the valuation right now, certainly what we've seen over the past couple of months, is a lot of excitement from investors, you know, regarding artificial intelligence, you know, and how that may end up playing through the technology sector over the years ahead. Now, when I think about artificial intelligence, you know, I think it's still very early innings as far as, you know, how that's necessarily going to impact stock valuations. I know talking to our equity analyst team that we do think that artificial intelligence, you know, will certainly be a positive factor for companies like Microsoft and Alphabet and Amazon. But I also know that our equity analyst team, you know, hasn't changed their fair values based on artificial intelligence just yet. I think what we're looking at is that artificial intelligence will be additive to those company business models as opposed to necessarily being transformative. So I think a lot of investors maybe are, you know, starting to price in a lot of excitement into those stocks without necessarily really having, you know, kind of the fundamental change in the valuations that the market is currently pricing in.
So can you think of an instance like this in the past, say within the past 5 years or so, where investors were extrapolating good recent performance and positive news flow well into the future beyond what was really reasonable for them to do?
There's a couple of different examples out there. Maybe none of them are really the exact same, but it's interesting that, you know, as I look through, you know, our valuations on a historical basis here, back at the beginning of 2018, the basic materials sector was the most overvalued sector, trading, I believe, at like a 25 to 30% premium over our fair values. You know, something that you really don't see happen very often. And then when I started digging into that, you know, a little bit further, there were even companies that were trading at 2x or 3x over what we thought the company was worth. And in that case, what we found is that, you know, there were companies like steel companies and building material suppliers that for the past decade had just been making money, you know, hand over fist as they were supplying, you know, the build out of China, which of course at that point, you know, had been going on for at least the past decade. And I do think that's an instance where investors were extrapolating those growth rates for too long going into the future and paying, you know, too much for those individual stocks.
So we've asked you about parts of the market that are looking particularly rich, and you cited a current example as well as one in the not too distant past. How about the flip side? What's looking invitingly cheap right now when you scan across sectors and industries?
Well, the sector that's still most undervalued right now is the communications sector. And there's still a lot of negative sentiment within communications in of itself. Now, it was the most undervalued sector coming into the year. And the thing you have to remember with communications is that both Alphabet and Meta are in the communications sector weightings. And of course, based on the size of both of those companies, the two of them together, I think about, you know, 55% of the market cap. So anything that those two companies do certainly skew, you know, that overall sector return. Meta, I think, has more than doubled, you know, thus far this year. It's gone from being a 5-star stock now to a 3-star stock. Alphabet is up, you know, pretty substantially as well. You know, that's one where we do still see some upside. It's a 4-star rated stock, but again, is, you know, certainly run a lot of the course thus far this year. But within communications, you know, we still find a lot of the traditional media companies, a lot of the traditional telecommunication companies, you know, are still very undervalued, specifically companies like AT&T and Verizon, companies where, you know, our analytical team, you know, is rating those, you know, 4 stars or 5 stars because we think that the market really is being very negative in the sentiment on those companies and not thinking through, you know, how the changes within that sector will play through. So, for example, I know that there's been, you know, consolidation in the wireless telecommunications area. You know, at this point, there's really an oligopoly. It's, you know, 3 main competitors between AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile. And so I know our analytical team is expecting a much more rational competition in the future as far as pricing than what we've seen in the past, which should then reflect, you know, well in the margins for those companies going forward.
So what's your take on this idea of stocks needing a catalyst to outperform? Do you think there's something to that notion, or is it kind of outmoded given the market's ability to price in new information before investors can actually act on it?
Well, when I think about catalysts, I usually think of that more in terms of trading than I do in investing. And I consider trading and investing to be, you know, 2 very different activities. And when we think about investing and intrinsic valuation, you know, we do suspect that, you know, there are times where it can take up to 3 years for a stock to converge towards its intrinsic value. So a catalyst can accelerate that process. But in our view, you know, it's that over time, you know, the market will always end up converging towards what that true underlying value of a company will be.
Small caps look cheaper than large caps, which I guess is not surprising considering the way stocks of larger firms have spanked those of smaller companies. Why have small caps slumped to this extent? And what do you think will reverse that trend?
You know, to a large degree, I think small caps have been under pressure. You know, the market really has been expecting the economy, you know, to weaken. You know, certainly was a greater chance probably at the beginning of the year that we were going to be heading into a recession. There were a lot of people that thought that if we did hit a recession that, you know, could be, you know, deep or prolonged. And I think that would have, you know, a lot more impact on those small cap stocks. Yeah, however, you know, the economy has been holding up better than expected. And so we do think that, you know, small cap stocks do have much better valuations as compared to the large cap stocks as a group going forward.
Sticking with various cuts of the market, I wanted to ask about quality because it seems like quality, as we define it at least, doesn't look cheap. You'd expect higher quality names to fetch higher multiples, all things being equal. But is it unusual to see what we call wide moat stocks trading as richly as they are today?
Yeah. And when I think about quality, it goes again back to the concept of an economic moat. You know, does this company have specific attributes that that company will be able to generate those excess returns on invested capital? And if so, you know, how long will those excess returns generate that cash before it gets competed away? And when I think about wide moat stocks, it's interesting that actually wide moat stocks lagged the market to the downside. I actually sold off more, you know, last year, whereas typically I would expect, you know, high quality companies to perform better to the downside, which is what we had seen historically. But a lot of the downside last year was in a lot of those technology mega cap stocks, which had, you know, a much higher beta to the downside. And that actually provided investors an opportunity last year to pick up, you know, a lot of those individual stocks trading at very low valuations. But of course, those wide moat stocks, you know, have rebounded. Yeah, I know the wide moat focus index was up, you know, I think over 20% year to date, whereas the rest of the market, when I measured that, was only up about 13 or 14%. So to some degree, that's kind of played itself out here, you know, in the first half of the year.
That's a good segue to the next question we wanted to ask, which is whether you think it's true that quality used to be associated with countercyclicality, that high quality stocks were more defensive. And to the extent that's changed, do you think that investors need to recalibrate their expectations about the risk and return profile of wide moat stocks going forward?
You know, I don't think so. I think it was unusual what we saw, you know, in 2022. You know, we did see a lot of the different parts of the market, you know, sell off to levels that had gotten back to just really, really low valuations. In fact, you know, the market itself, when it bottomed out in October of last year, had gotten to a price to fair value where the last time we saw it that low was actually back in 2011. And if you remember in 2011, you know, we had two things that were going on. We had, you know, the debt ceiling crisis here in the US, then we had the sovereign debt crisis and the banking crisis over in Europe. So we do think that the market overall had sold off, you know, just way too much, you know, last fall compared to our valuations. And I think it was probably more of an outlier that we saw how much those wide moat stocks, as that momentum was pushing the market down, actually fell more than the market. So I think going forward, I would suspect that we probably get back more towards, you know, kind of that historical norm where those high quality or wide moat stocks would hold their value better to the downside, you know, especially in a more normalized environment that even if we do have a recession, you know, we do expect, you know, according to our economics team, that any recession would be relatively short and shallow.
So, you know, kind of sticking with that, I wanted to ask you about macroeconomic questions. Do you think that, you know, the typical long-term investor should even factor in, you know, things like, will there be a recession when they're making their investment decisions?
I do, but I think it's to a much lower degree than I think what the media portrays. And of course, you know, the media is always trying to get people, you know, excited about what's going on in the markets and, you know, always really trying to hype up, you know, whatever the current events are. But really, when I'm thinking about, you know, macroeconomics and investing, I'm really watching more the trends than I am watching, you know, any one individual economic release. And so I think it's really more an indicator for, you know, the longer term trends for, you know, the individual stocks and thinking about, you know, how much these stocks and these companies will be able to make, you know, over the long term in different types of macroeconomic environments. You know, so for example, I know that, you know, we do think that here in the short term, the economic growth rate in the U.S., you know, will slow over the next couple of quarters. You know, that growth rate will really bottom out probably the beginning of next year and then reaccelerate to the upside. But I know our own view is that the U.S. economy, as it rebounds, our view of that economic rebound is much higher than the consensus view. And so I think that is part of the reason why we do think that stocks, you know, do remain undervalued, is because we do expect to have pretty good economic tailwinds, you know, 2, 3, 4 years out from today.
What are the macro indicators you pay the most attention to? And of those, which might directly inform an investment decision you'd make? And I guess I'd qualify that question to note that you said it's the trend you pay more attention to than it is maybe an individual data point. But all the same, there's probably some that you pay a little bit more attention to than others. Which are those, and which might inform an investment decision?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, yeah, I would have to mention, I do keep in pretty close contact with Preston Caldwell. You know, he's the head of our U.S. economics team. And, you know, for those that are interested in our view in economics, you know, he does put out his economic pulse and puts out, you know, regular updates on the economy and his views. So I would highly suggest, you know, reading through his publications there. But as far as, you know, watching the macroeconomic environment, my own personal focus is going to be on the leading economic indicators, you know, published by the Conference Board. And to me, that provides a much more holistic view of the economy and the trend in the economy than necessarily trying to watch, you know, any one individual metric. I'll leave that up to Preston.
So how about inflation? Because inflation seems to be gradually tapering off, but the yield on the 10-year Treasury bond has risen. Why is that happening?
Well, and again, it gets to the point where I think investors do need to separate, you know, what's happening in the short term versus a longer term view and, you know, longer term projections. So inflation isn't moderating, you know, nearly as fast as I think the market would prefer. So to some degree, we may have some people that are pricing in a higher probability that inflation, you know, may be elevated for longer. I also think that short-term interest rates are high enough now that they're attracting, you know, more investors to the shorter end of the curve and maybe away from the longer end of the curve. As you're getting, you know, these higher rates here in the short term, you know, you take on much less duration risk than you do in the longer end of the curve. And then we also just have, you know, the supply-demand dynamics. So the Fed is still in its quantitative easing mode. So they're letting bonds roll off. They'll then have to be refinanced in the marketplace, you know, so we're seeing additional supply there. But when we're thinking about the 10-year and where the yield will be going forward, we do think that this 4% area that we're in right now, you know, if that's not the peak, we expect that that's probably pretty close to the peak, and that over the next couple of years, we do look for the 10-year Treasury yield to be coming back down.
If we do have a recession, it seems like it will have been the most predicted recession in history, as it seems like people have been expecting that outcome for a while. Is that typical? And if not, is there reason to question whether a recession is the sure thing some forecasters seem to think it is?
Yeah. So, I mean, our own base case scenario right now is no recession. And, you know, that hasn't changed, you know, even since the beginning of the year. Yeah, you know, we do expect that the probability of a recession remains higher than what that probability has been in the past. I think Preston right now is looking for, you know, potentially a 30% probability of a recession. But having said that, if there were to be a recession, our view is that any recession would be relatively short and shallow.
Bonds took a beating last year. They're up a little bit this year, but down after inflation. So what does history suggest will be the tipping point where higher bond yields more than compensate for capital losses from rising interest rates?
So right now, you know, I would look for when bond yields provide investors with a positive real rate of return over inflation. And that combined with inflation being on a downward trajectory is really kind of that tipping point, I think, that you're looking for. And generally, I think we're either at or getting pretty close to that there, you know, right now. You know, inflation does continue to keep moderating. In fact, our U.S. economics team is looking for inflation to drop to a 2% year-over-year run rate by the end of this year and to average, you know, slightly below 2% next year and thereafter. So I do think that with the 10-year at 4%, I do think that now is probably a pretty good time for investors to think about, you know, being able to extend the duration, you know, in the fixed income market, you know, and be able to lock in some of these higher yields for now.
Just to follow up on what you mentioned a moment ago, I think that you indicated that we're expecting inflation to come down. Maybe you could just talk briefly about what it is you expect to drive inflation to those levels. I mean, a recession, as we expect, is disinflationary. So I suppose that would be one variable that would explain it. But what else?
Well, and I think a lot of it comes down to the factors that actually had caused a lot of the inflation in the first place. So, you know, we had seen a lot of different bottlenecks, a lot of different supply disruptions, which had worked their way through the system, causing some supply issues and causing prices to rise. We see a lot of those working themselves out now. Energy prices, you know, at this point, are certainly well off the highs that we saw, especially from when Russia first invaded Ukraine. And we also expect that energy prices will be on a longer-term downward trajectory. In fact, our team that covers the energy sector, their long-term forecast for oil is for $55 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate. That's currently, I think, around $70 right now. So it's a combination of, you know, those things that drove inflation higher in the past, we think are behind us. And so we don't have, you know, those same kind of dynamics going forward, as well as, you know, a lot of the demographic changes that Preston utilizes in his inflation model.
I wanted to ask about the yield curve, which remains inverted with shorter maturity bonds sporting higher yields than longer bonds. That sort of inversion has been a good predictor of recessions in the past, but not this time, at least not so far. Why?
Well, and you have to remember, too, that the Fed only controls the short end of the curve. And that's really an indicator of, you know, what they're doing for monetary policy. And as they've been tightening monetary policy, they've been raising the short-term rates, and that has brought up the short-term yield. Whereas I do think that some investors are out there still thinking of, you know, a recession here in the near term. And I think a lot of those investors, you know, may have revised their portfolio allocations to, you know, reduce their equity exposure and move that money, you know, into bonds with the expectation that, you know, if we do enter a recession, stocks would fall during that recession, and then they could move that money back into stocks. So I know with our outlook, you know, of sequential growth slowing, we do expect that as that growth rate slows and then with inflation, you know, continuing to keep coming down, this hike that, you know, we expect here in July will be the last hike for this monetary tightening policy cycle. And that at that point, you know, the Fed will pause. And we do think that the combination of lower inflation as well as a slowing economy will actually give the Fed the room that it would need to then start easing monetary policy. You know, I believe our projection is that they would actually start cutting interest rates in February of next year. And then Preston does expect the Fed then would be able to cut interest rates, you know, relatively quickly over the course of 2024. And as those interest rates are coming down, that actually then will provide a tailwind to the economy next year and keep us out of a recession.
We wanted to spend a few minutes on credit and risk. High yield spreads have narrowed pretty meaningfully over the past year. What do spreads tell us about risk appetite? And also, what does it tell us about the likelihood of recession?
Yeah, the high yield index on a spread basis has done, you know, pretty well thus far this year. I think the Morningstar U.S. high yield index, the average credit spread started at about 480 at the beginning of the year. You know, last I checked, we're getting pretty close to 410 right now. And I think the market was just pricing in a much higher probability of a recession at the beginning of the year, which of course, you know, in a recessionary environment would lead to an increase in both, you know, downgrades and defaults. Now, our base case was no recession. So at the beginning of the year, we did think that corporate credit spreads were, well, relatively attractive. But with the economy more resilient than expected, and, you know, some of the economic metrics we've seen, you know, more recently still showing the economy slowing but not dipping into recession, I think investors, high yield investors, are pricing in a lower probability of recession, which means that you don't need to get as much extra compensation over the underlying interest rate because you don't have, you know, as many potential defaults or downgrades coming.
So money-losing firms got crushed, but they've perked up a little bit lately. Is this a sign that conditions have improved and credit and capital aren't as tight as they'd become? Or do you think it's that investors are anticipating that these money losers will turn profitable at some point?
Well, it's always hard to know when investors are anticipating, you know, those companies that are currently cash flow negative as to, you know, when they would turn profitable. But I do agree that the credit markets and the capital markets aren't necessarily as tight as they've become. Talking to, you know, some of our colleagues, you know, over at PitchBook, you know, they do note that there is still, you know, plenty of capital available in the private equity markets and in the venture capital markets that is looking to be, you know, put to work. But, you know, as with anything, you know, I would try and caution investors, you know, not to necessarily try to read too much into the short-term dynamics here. When you look at those type of companies, you know, they're going to be very volatile as to, you know, slight changes in the outlook can result in pretty large price swings. And a lot of that could just even just be investor sentiment having an outsized effect. So again, generally, I would expect that, you know, financing is available for those companies when it's needed, but it's probably going to be, you know, at much tighter terms and higher interest rates than they would have had before.
Relatedly, I think people came into this year, or at least some people came into this year, thinking that cash, having such a high interest rate, offering such a high hurdle rate, that riskier assets would continue to struggle. That hasn't really happened. So what has that experience taught us?
Yeah, a couple of things, I think. So one, valuations really are always going to end up, you know, determining market returns, you know, over a longer time period. And I do think that sometimes the markets, you know, act like a pendulum in the short term, that you can see, you know, the market swing from being, you know, overvalued and then swing too far to the downside to being undervalued and going back and forth, both, you know, from a market perspective as well as an individual stock perspective. And in our view, the market had just gotten to be, you know, too far undervalued, you know, last fall. And even though there was still like some negative sentiment for, you know, the economic outlook based on those valuations, I think that brought some investors, you know, back into the marketplace. And then thinking about cash and those high short-term rates, you also have to remember that we had, you know, those really low rates a couple of years ago with zero interest rate policy. And you had some investors that, you know, moved out of the fixed income area when fixed income bonds were paying, you know, such rock bottom yields, moving into the equity space, using equities almost as like fixed income substitutes, especially areas like the consumer defensive and utilities that paid, you know, high dividend yields. And so I think a lot of those investors, you know, have already kind of made those reallocations back to where they should have been, back into, you know, fixed income and out of stocks.
I wanted to switch over and talk about real estate. Everyone seems to be talking about how they're worried about commercial real estate, the office subsector in particular. It seems we share some of those concerns, but have they been more than priced in? And if so, does that present a buying opportunity in your opinion?
Well, it's a yes and a no answer. So I do agree that I think that, you know, the urban office space in particular could still see some downward valuation adjustments. But away from that space, you know, we do see a lot of opportunities, you know, in commercial real estate. And, you know, a number of the REITs that we cover, we do think are, you know, pretty undervalued at this point. So I would just recommend for investors, you know, in that real estate area, look for those areas where you see foot traffic, you know, either steady or returning. So for example, a couple of the stocks that are invested in, you know, Class A shopping malls, with the pandemic, you know, well behind us, we've seen foot traffic in those malls, you know, return back towards pre-pandemic levels. Plus, I think it's also interesting, you know, in the real estate area where, you know, they've made changes to the actual real estate itself in order to bring in that foot traffic. So like the Class A shopping malls have made themselves, you know, much more experiential over the years and less reliant just purely upon the retailers. So for example, you'll see, you know, a lot more restaurants and physician offices, even gyms, things like that in order to bring, you know, the foot traffic back into the malls. Some of the other areas that I would highlight would be the data centers. I just think that there's still a long-term secular trend for more data and more storage needs. And I think, you know, artificial intelligence adoption actually could also bolster, you know, the case for the data centers. areas like, you know, senior housing, again, you still have kind of that long-term secular trend for an aging population. So we see that supporting the senior housing market. You know, and other areas too that never really sold off as much as some of these other areas, but still do provide some good returns from dividend income and maybe like the medical office space.
So I want to ask about residential because Morningstar is expecting residential construction to pick up next year thanks to lower mortgage rates and more affordable prices. But rates are still pretty high. So what do we think brings mortgage rates down from here? And what makes us confident it will be enough to induce reluctant sellers who have those low mortgage rates locked in to list their homes?
Yeah, so we do forecast that interest rates, you know, will come back down next year. So thinking in terms of like the federal funds rate, you know, I know that we're expecting that to decline from, you know, 5% right now. That'll end up averaging about 4%, maybe a little bit over 4% in 2024, and then fall, you know, much further all the way down to a little bit over 2% in 2025. And of course, that would then bring down those buyers in the adjustable rate mortgage area, you know, since those are going to be tied to the short-term rates. And then as far as, you know, long-term mortgages, you know, we do forecast that the 10-year U.S. Treasury will decline to an average of 3.5% in 2024 and fall even further all the way down to 2.5% on average in 2025. So our thesis, you know, is really that in the residential construction market, currently, there isn't enough existing homes to satisfy that new household formation. So I think it's a combination of those lower mortgage rates that improve affordability, as well as, you know, that demand from new household formation, you know, is going to spur the new construction over the next couple of years.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for sharing your insights and perspectives with us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Christine.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you could, please take a minute to subscribe to and rate the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
And at Christine_Benz.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. While this guest may license or offer products and services of Morningstar and its affiliates, unless otherwise stated, he or she is not affiliated with Morningstar and its affiliates. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.